Okay, thanks. Thanks, Sandy. Thanks for this nice introduction and for the invitation. Today I will tell you about some very recent work that was published just a couple of weeks ago in Plus Genetics. So everything I will tell you about today, you can find it there. So my goal is to introduce you to... I wanted to give you some really some sense of the kind of results you can get with the method that I've been developing over the years, which we call in silico evolution. I really wanted to give you now a clear result, illustration of this method. I won't tell you much about the method itself. I will just very briefly summarize it. But if you want to have more details about the method itself, I can tell you more. And I will, at the very end of my talk, I will just show you two examples of other application of this method, very briefly, but connected to segmentation, vertebrate segmentation, and to what Alexander will tell just after me. But for now, we're going to focus on this problem, which is predicting ancestral segmentation from types of fly to mosquito. So what do I mean by this? So there is a, I'm interested in evolution. In this talk, I'm going to talk about evolution. And one of the very classical question evolution is that how can you reconstruct common ancestors and past evolutionary history. And so I like this example because it gives you a very, very visual instance of this problem. So imagine you have you have coral pigments. Today, you can observe coral pigments. And so imagine you want to reconstruct the phylogenetic tree of coral pigments. And so the typical way you would do it now is that you have the DNA sequence. And so let's say, so it's a very sketchy way of describing this. So you have DNA sequence of today's coral pigments. And so based on this, we can somehow, using a very classical method, a parsimonious assumption, you can try to reconstruct a common ancestor just based on number of mutations that you expect on an evolutionary tree. So like here you have like these two guys, TTGA, TTGC. And you define the out group, and then you use classical methods to essentially reconstruct the evolutionary pathway. So I'm not a specialist on that, but this is doable. And so this is what they did. So these people did that in a very visual way. They took these pigments, and so they reconstructed the sequence of the pigments. And so you see very nicely how the ancestral pigment was green and was slightly becoming reddish as it evolved. So that's a well-defined problem, and we have a well-defined solution because of the DNA sequence, essentially. We have the DNA. So we can do it in a rather systematic way. But what happens if you don't have necessary DNA? For instance, imagine, so this is a problem I'm going to tell you about today. Imagine you have like three insects or more than that, and you could have several insects like Drosophila, Chlamydia, Anopheles. And so you see this beast, and so you wonder what can you predict on the common ancestor? So let's call it Eurodipteran or whatever. Just looking at these species, how can you do that? How can you reconstruct anything on the ancestor? And so this is actually a classical problem, and this is what people were doing before all the DNA advances, DNA sequencing advance. They were doing, for instance, things like comparative anatomy plus taxonomy to somehow predict the common ancestor of all these animals. So for instance, you can consider all these animals, and so based on morphological studies and blah blah blah, again things I'm not a specialist of that, then you can infer that the common ancestor had a limb like this with five fingers, and so different structure in the limb of this animal. So you can do that. The problem is that it's very it's very difficult, and it's kind of very qualitative. There is no systematic way. I mean there are rule of thumbs, but there is no quantitative way to do that. And so the question I would like to answer today is that can we try to mathematize something like this? That's really the goal of my talk, and to convince you that in some instances you can mathematize this. Okay, and so to do that I'm going to use a physical analogy. In physics, you can consider things called energy landscapes. And so for instance, I could be, imagine you have chemical reactions, and so you put chemical reactants together, and so they will give you some products. So, so you have an abstract space, with chemical coordinates, so that would be here, for instance, the reactants, and so you put them together, and so you have an intermediate state, very quick, usually, and so you go back to, then you go to a product state. And so you have two states in this kind of energy landscape. And a classical problem in physics, or in thermophysics, or thermochemistry, whatever you call it, is how can I predict the trajectories between these two states? And physicists have developed methods to do that. So there is, for instance, the method called the Langevin bridge method. So basically, you summarize a potential, a bias potential, to somehow infer what is the most probable trajectory in this coordinate, chemical coordinate space. Or a very classical way to do this is just to use Monte Carlo. You try to simulate, you know, and you try to see what is somehow the minimum, you know, the one, the least costly path in this coordinate space to get from a reactant to product. So we know to do this problem in physics, and I would like to draw an analogy with biology and with inferring phylogenetic trees. So I would like to tell, okay, again, it's very qualitative, very sketchy, but it gives you a sense of what I will do later. So I would like to say, so okay, maybe today's species are like, you know, different whales in this energy landscape. So, you know, this guy would be here, this guy would be there. And so maybe the problem of inferring the common ancestor is a bit like finding actually the most plausible pathway between these two species. And so the ancestor will be some kind of saddle in this energy landscape. That's kind of the idea I'm going to talk about. So now if we have the, and so now, you know, like evolution, the way it works, you know, you are somewhere here and then you somehow, you know, decrease in this fitness landscape. Yeah, okay, I'm always decreasing fitness and not increasing fitness because I'm a physicist, like to minimize stuff and not to maximize stuff. I apologize. But, you know, usually you would be very, very up there, like, you know, in the past, and so then evolution happens. So you decrease your energy or you increase your fitness, and then, you know, somewhere in the past, then you will have a separation here, and so they will give you, say, fly, and they will give you mosquito, and then here you have an insect. That's not a completely accurate picture, of course, but let's imagine that, you know, something like this is working. Well, so, yeah. Sure.
I'm a little bit stuck on the assumptions here. I would have thought evolution was maybe a change in the
energy. In the fitness landscape.
So I'm not really comfortable with this idea of saying, well, the ancestor is at the saddle.
I see what you mean.
I guess I'm kind of struggling to try to think about why I should say that's a good way to think about
it. It's more, okay. It's more an analogy on what I do in the simulation, okay? Now, can I really literally say that the ancestor is a saddle?
Maybe.
Say.
If the conditions change in the environment, yeah, would that point used to be saddle, and then it just...
It could be unstable, yes. A bit like what Francis described yesterday. That's a good answer, thank you. So yeah, maybe these two fixed points did not exist, so you would go there first, and then the energy landscape would change so that you will... Yes?
Well, just correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you're saying this is a fitness landscape. You don't mean to say that, do you?
Do I need to say it's a fitness landscape? Well, okay, I was about to say it's a bit like the fitness landscape.
Okay, good.
Okay. But then you're right, this fitness landscape might change the environmental condition with time. I was about to say that.
You surely don't mean
you. So why do you disagree?
Oh, Paul, I don't. No. I'm just asking. Just asking. Please go ahead.
Okay, but you know, this is just going to give you an intuition about what is going to happen in the simulation. Then you can make it more or less rigorous. But yeah, okay. So my idea is that the idea is that the energy landscape is a bit like the fitness landscape. And you'll see the fitness landscape will be, you know, a bit more coarse grain. I will tell you about that later on. And then the coordinates, so now you have to think about what are the coordinates in this landscape. This will be the genotype, essentially, so the DNA sequence. Something like that. Okay? So that's my physical analogy, and so I'm going to play with this. And so now let's go back to this problem. I have my insects, and I want to infer what is the ancestral insect. So now how do I define a fitness landscape on that? So obviously that's a bit difficult. So I'm a physicist. I'm going to use a simplification. So I'm going to use my favorite spherical cows, which are these embryos. I'm going to go back to embryonic development. And so now, the reason why I'm doing this is that because it's a bit easier to compare embryos like this. So these are embryo segmented embryos. So you see here Drosophila, Chlorgmia, Anopheles. Anopheles is mosquito. And so you see that these embryos have very similar pattern of Eve stripes. So here you have Eve. And so here you have Eve, and I don't know if it's Peshitarazu or Odd. It's probably Odd. But anyway, you see the stripes. And so now the question, so now it's a good, the reason why I'm doing this, and you know, obviously it's because I can constrain a bit more the problem, because I can just focus on segmentation. And so now I can ask the question not on the general animal, but on segmentation. Now I have this segmentation phenotypes. Can I reconstruct the ancestral segmentation phenotype with the knowledge I have? So that's the problem I'm going to study. And so how am I going to deal with that? So I told you I need to, so you know, again using my physical analogy of fitness landscape and coordinate in this genotype space. So my fitness will be, so I'm going to come back to the to the fitness, precisely what I mean by the fitness, but the fitness will be something like the right number of stripes. So I want to have, this insect must have 7 Eve stripes. Or 7 Eve stripes, 7 Fushitarazu stripes, or you know, 7 pair rule, I mean like 7 × 4 pair rule stripes at roughly at the correct position. So I come back to that later. I will describe what I mean by the fitness, but that will be my fitness landscape. And now in terms of genotypes, well, what I have, so especially for the fly, we have a quite good knowledge of what the genotype is. And I'm not going to study the DNA sequence because I don't know how to do that and that's too complicated. I'm going to use some kind of phenomenological description of these genotypes, which is more like a gene network approach. And so I know that there are gap genes, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to dissect this in 1 second. From this gap gene, I can make a phenomenological model of all the interaction, and then I can tell you, I can write an equation for each of the gap gene, each of these each stripe. And so from that, compute essentially a pattern of genetic expression. So that will be my genotype, and the phenotype will be the associated pattern of genetic expression. That's my only equation, just to give you a sense of the kind of formalism it is. It's really like, you know, ODEs, formalism, Hill functions for transcription, and then you have a local dilution. Okay? So is it clear for everybody? Okay, so now I have to, so to go on, I have to somehow remind you of some of the aspects of segmentation, because that will come, that will be useful to tell you about the actual prediction of this algorithm. So I'm going to, yeah, so it's just a summary of what the plan is. I'm going to use this formalism to somehow make a Monte Carlo simulation to get from Drosophila to Anopheles. So again, that's my physical analogy. I have these two minima, and I'm going from one to the other using Monte Carlo simulation. And the hope is that I can make predictions along the way and predict the ancestral state, the ancestral dipteran or an intermediate species. And you will see what I mean by prediction. Okay. Okay, so now, so now I'm going to focus on this first part, which is how do I go from Drosophila to Anopheles? How can I essentially, you know, transform a fly into a mosquito? And why it's an interesting problem? Because of course, if you know the gene networks are completely identical, there is nothing to do. But it turns out that gene networks are obviously not identical, and so that's why it's a difficult problem. So I'm going to walk you through very quickly the fly aspect. So the fly side, we know a lot on fly. I mean, you've seen this, you know about this. So just a couple of reminders of how this is working, how do you make segmentation in fly. So you have the maternal genes, like Bicoid and other genes. So they make gradients. So these gradients, they position roughly gap genes. So I will be modeling only 5 gap genes, Hunchback, Crookhorn, Knops, Giant, Tailess. And so then, so the gap genes have a slightly less extension, slightly smaller extension than the gap genes. So essentially, at the interface between gap genes, you have pair rule genes that are expressed. So you have many of them, Eve, Runt, Fushitarazu, Harry, Odd, many of them. And so then, based on the pair rule genes, you build the segment polarity genes. And so then, when you have the segment polarity genes, you can actually define the segments. So it's really like a very nice cascade where you progressively refine. And the genes in one cascade have, as read as input the gene in one step of the cascade, read as input the gene in the previous stage of the cascade.
Do they interact at the same level?
Sorry?
Is there, for example, mutual inhibition acting at the same
level? Yeah, yeah, they are.
Not indicated by arrows here.
No, I know, but they are. You're right. Yeah, they are like gap genes mutually repressed. Perugines, I will actually come back later to this. There is a distinction between primary and secondary perugines. So yes, there are interactions.
And it's rather important because otherwise you wouldn't be able to have arrow walls being exclusive.
I come back to all. This is something that is going to come later, actually. Okay. So that's just sketchy description of this. Okay, so one thing I want to spend some time on, so I don't know what you've been doing during the summer school. I mean, it's probably a reminder for most of you, but there is this kind of paradigm in the field, which I'm not going to attack this paradigm. I completely agree with this paradigm, or at least within this framework, I'm fine with this paradigm. Which is how do you make basically things like each tribe? And so this is something that I think this is the first really instance in 91 of this the first explicit description of this paradigm, which is that if you have if stripe, say if stripe 2 here. Then the way each stripe is regulated is basically you have giant and cruple giant anterior to it and cruple posterior to it, and so giant essentially defines via repression the anterior if stripe boundary, while cruple represses if, and so that defines the posterior if stripe boundary. So there is this idea that essentially you define position information of the stripes via repression, and most of the time only one gap gene is enough to basically position them properly this if stripe. So if you remember what Eric Vichos showed us the other day, if you remember one gap gene was almost enough to really position one cell with correct accuracy. So this completely fits with this stripe paradigm that only one gap gene locally can position one boundary. So that's for if stripe 2. And so there are many tests of this hypothesis. I like this test, which is that essentially if you can, so you can use bioinformatics method to somehow detect what are the regulators of a given gene. And so this way you can extract what are called modules, genetic modules that are going to correspond to localized genetic expression. And so there is this very nice paper by Schroeder, and so that's a collaboration between the CGI and the Gaul group from 2004, where they could really predict very nice module. And so then based on what regulates this genetic module, they could really predict where these stripes were, essentially these stripes were expressed. And so the other point I want to make here is that these things are relatively modular. You can really separate different modules. So for instance, here you have odd, and so you see that this module here basically defines odd 3 and odd probably 5 or something. So you have like very, very nice, very small pieces of DNA corresponding to very tight, very nice, very well-defined positions in the embryo. Okay? And so why am I telling you all of this? It's just to give you a sense of the way I'm going to build the initial model. And so to do the fly mosquito transformation, I need to have a fly model. And I'm going to use a very simplified fly model with relatively minimum information about how the different stripes are positioned and how the different gap genes are positioned. And so this is a summary of the model. So you see it's quite complicated. But the way to describe this model, with a bit of hand waving, the way to describe this model is that essentially gap genes position themselves by repression using also positional information from maternal genes, such as Bicoid. And so if stripes and Fushitarasu stripes, I'll tell you later about Fushitarasu, they are positioned via a local gap gene repression. So you can build a model like this. So the way I build this model is really to use both knowledge from genetics and also from direct studies of binding sites and stuff like this. So for instance, there are some interactions that we know that exist genetically, but we don't quite know through what they are implemented. But essentially, you know, this is just review the literature and so build these things and I think it's a very plausible model. So if you want, I can give you later details on the models, but I don't want to go too much into the detail of these models because that's rather complicated.
You try to build one model that fits as much data as you can.
Okay, so
there could be many such models.
So here I'm doing a model for fly. Okay, so I try to build one model for fly based on what we know on the genetic interaction in flies. And with minimum parameter, for what I want to do, which is to, you see later, we're going to change this model. We're going to change parameters of this model. So it's related to the fitness. I'm going to discuss the fitness in 1 second. I'm not trying to think overfit or include all possible interactions. I'm more on the line of building a minimum model. You know, if I remove one interaction in this model, something wrong is happening. And usually, this something wrong is described in the literature as stride fusion of gap gene. You know, this is the idea of this model.
I'm just wondering if your conclusion would depend on the exact choice of the model you take. Because
okay.
Maybe it could be very degenerate, right? The space of models.
Okay, that's a good question. I can answer this question maybe at the end of the talk. You will see the predictions, and then the prediction will certainly depend on some of the hypotheses in the model, but not all the hypotheses of this model. Yes?
Paul, I've read your work, so I know where it's going, but to connect it to Francis's stuff yesterday, there's a temporal part here. That you're kind of ignoring.
No, actually, I tell you about temporal.
Oh, really?
I'm not going to tell much about temporal, but I can tell you more offline. You're right, there is a temporal part. And I will tell you about this
great,
a little
great,
bit.
Thank you.
Okay? And I think it matters, actually.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so sorry, I have to do something which is because it's going to be important to describe the result. I have to walk you through a little bit the Eve regulation. So I'm going to focus on Eve stripes 2 to 7. And so the way, again, the way it works is that the Eve stripes are sandwiched between gap genes. So Eve 2, which is here. So I'm not going to, again, I'm not considering Eve 1, so that's why you only have 6 stripes here. So Eve 2, I'm going to assume it's so what is known is that it's repressed by Krupal posteriorly and by Giant anteriorly. So there is one module. Eve 5 is basically the same as Krupal and Giant, except that this is Giant posterior and Krupal anterior. So Eve 2 and Eve 5 are relatively similar. And Eve 5 is going to be an important player in what I'm going to describe. So remember this, it's repressed by Krupal and repressed by Giant. Now the other important players are Eve 3, 7, Eve 4, 6. So you have this very, very fascinating phenomenon that one genetic module essentially defines 2 stripes. And you have twice this. So Eve 3 and 7, they are defined by the same genetic module, which is repressed by KNURPS and repressed by Hunchback. And so this defines Eve 3, Eve 7 here. So you have one Hunchback here and one posterior Hunchback here. So you see at I Hunchback, you have the boundary of Eve 3 and 7. And so you have KNURPS in the middle that is strongly repressing Eve 3 and 7. And Eve 4 and 6 is basically the same, but with some inverted strengths of interaction, where KNURPS represses Eve 4 and 6, and Hunchback strongly represses Eve 4 and 6. So you have 4 modules that define 6 stripes. 2 modules defining 2 stripes. So it's going to, yes?
So once you have the network, basically what you do is some kind of rear chain diffusion.
Yeah. So I showed this equation. So it's very, it's when I have, let's say, this, when I say Krupal represses Eve, it means that I have a Hill function in front of E production rate that is decreasing with Krupal.
Okay,
so, and then I have a degradation. You can put diffusion, that doesn't matter, actually. But this needs to be relatively weak. Diffusion smooths a little bit the pattern, so that gives you slightly more beautiful pattern. But for what I'm going to tell you, it doesn't really matter.
Okay?
But yeah, you are, again, it's very simple. The simplest non-Boolean thing you can think about. It's not Boolean, but it's not much more complicated than that.
It was
all the spatial information comes from the Bitcoin gradient?
Yeah, pretty much, yes.
You postulate the Bitcoin gradient, and then everything is just...
Yeah. There's a little bit of diffusion, so that's not completely true. But again, for what I'm going to show you, the diffusion does not really matter. It matters for to give you, you know, more precise and more beautiful pattern, but for the qualitative result I'm going to show you, that doesn't matter. Actually, no, that's not completely true, because I have to put posterior gradients as well.
Right, yeah.
I have to put posterior gradients. So you have things like tailless, cubin, caudal. Caudal is negated by Bitcoin, so that's not completely true.
Right. Can you stipulate those? Or
you have to assume that you have those gradients. And actually, that's something that it's actually surprisingly difficult to find information about regulation, say, by tailless. I mean, you have limited information, but you have to assume some stuff. I mean, one problem we have, for instance, is that, okay, let me give you one example of the problem you have. So if you say Hunchback represses Eve, then you see that Hunchback is done here. So why aren't you actually reactivating Eve in the posterior? So you need to have a repressor that is repressing Eve there. And that actually is actually going to matter. Because you see, Mosquito, Hunchback is more anterior. So that opens room to re-express Eve, which is going to be one of the crucial things we'll see in the simulations. Yes?
Are there more things that you're not showing us? Or is this just okay. To explain this?
So this is for Eve. In the real system, they will...
For example, why is E5 not expressed in the same place as E2?
That's a good question. Why isn't so? Because, I don't remember. It's because probably Giant is repressing it. Yeah, I don't know. I need to check. You're right. There might be something missing here, I need to check.
It could be the strength of Bitcoin.
It should be the strength of Bitcoin. No, but Bitcoin should be. I need to check. But for instance, but this EVE2, E5, okay, so to make a long story short, I'm actually happy to have E5 re-expressed here. I don't care. It's important because you'll see that probably, okay, actually I won't show it, but E5 is probably, you know, one idea we have that E5 is coming from a duplication of EVE2 or something like this. And that's something it's known for FUTS. FUTS 5 is a duplication of FUTS 1. And you see stuff like this in the simulations. So, okay, anyway.
EVE1,
you're right. EVE1 and E5 are related, actually. So it could be that something like this also is happening, that you have a different threshold for EVE1 and E5.
But you don't like EVE1.
No, it's because it's not very interesting. Okay. No, I should not say that. Why I'm not really interested in EVE1, it's because the anterior part of all deterrents are essentially the same. It's really the posterior part that you have some variation. And so if I'm interested in the evolutionary problem, I'm more going to focus on what changes. If something is conserved, it's not really interesting. That said, the fact that the anterior part is conserved actually is somehow a strong statement that gives you idea on how you can modulate the posterior part, because you see that you use the anterior part of the gene network to define the posterior part of the gene network. Yes.
Question about phylogenetics. Can you look at the enhancers and really build an evolutionary tree?
Okay, so that's a good question. So Eric has tried this.
Of just the Eve, I'm asking.
Eric has tried this, so you can do it to only very, for very up to say a couple of tens of million years. Like if you were to directly go to Mosquito, it's 200 million years. You don't see anything. So that's also one of the justification why we're doing this, because essentially the enhancers might change a lot, but their function might be conserved.
Got it.
But you will not see it on DNA. If you do it on DNA, you will not see it. But if you do it on the phenotype, you might see something. Okay, that's good, because I wanted to make this point later on, and I could not find a way to make it, so that's good, I do it now. Okay?
So speaking of great distances, Anopheles has Bitcoin?
No, okay, that's another thing. So we're going to assume that something is taking the role of Bitcoin. There is not, there is no lack of candidates, OTX, other genes like this. So, somewhere in the line, Bitcoin appeared and somehow. I'm just in an anterior gradient. Positional information given by an anterior gradient. So I call it Bitcoin, but I could call it something else.
Okay. supposed to be hunchback. And hunchback is already constrained by other things, so it's not really up for grabs.
Could be hunchback, yes. I tell you, I mean, things are happening for hunchback posterior, so I don't know for hunchback anterior how that would change the picture. Yeah. I'm not making any statement on this. I'm just saying there is some position information given by a gradient, a Bicoid-like gradient. Okay. Okay, so that's a fly size. So we know a lot about flies as all model organisms. So now, if I want to know, again, the problem is to infer the ancestor of fly and mosquito. So what do we have on the mosquito side? And unfortunately, on mosquitoes, there is really, really limited information on all of this. Most of everything I will tell you about today is coming from this paper published in 2004. So I really try to look for follow-up papers. I mean, of course, I don't know all the literature, but I could not find anything as precise as this paper. I understood it's very difficult to work with mosquito eggs. You have to boil them or stuff like that. I ask people. It seems to be an horror. I don't know if Ken is more familiar with this, but that's what I've been told, that you have to. It's really difficult to work with mosquito, which explains why we have more limited information. But also, in some way, having more limited information makes the problem more appealing, because you're just trying to see. You have sparse information. What can you tell from sparse information? That's also one aspect of this problem that I find interesting. Okay, what do we know about mosquito? So people have looked at the gap genes in mosquito, and so okay. So at first sight, so this is mosquito, so it's hunchback who broke Knopf's giant. This is early hunchback. You immediately notice differences in the posterior regions. So for instance, here. You have a posterior, very well-known posterior hunchback in fly that you don't have in mosquito first. And then for giant, same thing. You have a posterior, a nice, very nice giant stripe that you don't have in mosquito. So clearly, the posterior part are different. And then you see, this is the next slide, actually. Later on, some giant and hunchback expression appear. And that will probably matter for our problem. I mean, that matters for our problem. What is really nice, and the first thing that is striking when I'm a physicist, I thought that you only had seven stripes all the time, but in mosquito that's not true, you can have an eight stripe appearing. So that I found quite fascinating the first time I saw this paper. So you have an extra stripe compared to fly. Okay? So now what happens is that later, in the posterior, later on, you have hunchback that is expressed. So it's relatively weakly. I mean, you know, of course, these are sometimes difficult to know, to be quantitative on institutes like this. But you could definitely have some hunchback expressed here. You have a giant that is expressed. But if you look, compare to the other embryo, giants probably not doing anything on segmentation here. So it's very, very posterior here. And so now what you see is that, so basically, there is a temporal aspect. Because early on, there is no posterior hunchback. But then later on, you have a posterior hunchback. And so now for Eve, early on, you have seven stripes. And later on, you have eight stripes. And OK, you don't quite see here on the slide, actually. But now this is a double staining of hunchback and Eve. And actually, hunchback is right here. You see it much better on the screen. You cannot really see. You barely see it here. But the posterior hunchback is right here between six and seven stripe. Okay. So to summarize, what do we know? And that's pretty much what we know on the gap genes and the Eve in mosquito. We don't know. We don't have DNA. We don't have any bioinformatics study. We don't have temporal information. We have very, very limited information. So just to summarize, so that's from a figure from this paper from Goldsef. You have so the big difference is for posterior giant and hunchback. They are expressed much later. And so relative to flies, there is some kind of inversion. So this is flies, this is mosquito. So giant is relatively anterior, so just next to E5, while hunchback is much more posterior. But for mosquito, later on, hunchback is more like it's closer to E5, and giant is very posterior. And so another thing is that you have up to eight Eve stripes in mosquito. And so the last point is that, as Boris mentioned, there is no Bicoid in mosquitoes. So I already answered to this question, so I'm not coming back to this. But that's another difference. Yes?
Well, do you find a pattern? Obviously, Hox genes at the bottom
are
very certain position.
Yeah.
Would you qualitatively say the further up you go in the segmentation network, the more kind of just, you know.
Okay, so I don't know enough about origins in insect to tell anything about origins. What I know is that there are these theories of hourglass theory. People have discussed this in the insect context, that you have, you know, like the very bottom layer when you define segments, like the perroutines, perroute expression are very conserved, and then the higher you go in the cascade, the more changes you have. This is what I know. I don't really, you know, I'm not an expert in this, so I don't have any strong opinion on that. But I mean, I believe people, you know.
Yeah.
Now that said, do I see something like this in my simulation? Well, you tell me at the end, okay? We can discuss afterwards. Okay. So. So. The difference between fly and mosquito is that essentially the posterior part, essentially starting from Eve 4, looks different. And so the question you can ask now is that if I take the fly network and try to change parameters to get the gap genes position as is mosquito, which I can do presumably. You know, I need to invert somehow the relative position of giant and hunchback, but I could tune parameters potentially to do that. So what will happen to the flying mosquito? And so then what happens, you are in trouble, basically. And so I call that the E5 conundrum for myself. So I'm going to describe the E5 conundrum. So what happens to E5? So E5 in fly, it's repressed by Krupal anteriorly and by giant posteriorly. But then I told you that essentially in mosquito, there is basically no giant posterior. So if I remove giant, boom, then E5 should extend like this. And so you no longer have a strap, you have like a huge domain of Eve. And so something is not working here. So I cannot just take blindly the fly network and somehow change the regulation of the gap genes to get the mosquito network. So that means that the regulations cannot be conserved, something must happen. And that's why it's an interesting problem. You know, it's not completely clear how you can evolve something, or you can go from fly to mosquito because of things like this. OK. So now this is a problem I'm going to study. I'm taking this network, this fly network, and I want to get the mosquito pattern. And so the constraint I have is that posterior giant and hunchback are essentially inverted compared to fly in mosquito. I have potentially more E-stripe in mosquito than in fly. And I have issues like the E5 conundrum. So I don't want, basically, I don't want to break the E pattern. So these are the constraints I'm doing. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to try to use Monte Carlo simulation on this network to try to solve these issues and predict a mosquito network.
You decide what should be a constraint and what you hope to come out of here. So
okay.
I could hope that, you know, if you put the right thing in, maybe you'll actually evolve an inversion of giant.
No, you're right. Okay. Let me discuss the fitness, and maybe we can, you know, when I'm going to discuss the fitness, I'm going to address some of these issues. Okay, you're right that of course, you know, you only what you get depends on your hypothesis. I'm certainly not attacking this, but I'm trying to make a minimum number of hypotheses. I'm really trying to minimize the number of hypotheses I'm making to try to be as generic as possible.
Right. I guess I'm asking, why do you need?
Why do I need what?
Well, I don't know what you mean stipulate, but do you?
I tell you the fitness, and then we can. Okay, maybe it's easier. Okay. So to do this, so now. So how am I going to do this? I'm going to do some Monte Carlo simulations. I'm basically going to change this network. And the way I'm going to do this is using some kind of evolutionary computations. I've been doing this for years, so I don't want to spend too much time on this. And it's relatively simple Darwinian computation. So imagine you have a population of networks. Then you are going to randomly change parameters. And so you randomly change parameters, so you compute something called a fitness. So I tell you about the fitness in 1 second, and so that relates to your question, Arye. So I'm computing fitness, then I'm working networks based on fitness, then I do some selection and duplication of the networks. So I order the network based on this fitness, and then I keep the best half and I duplicate the best half, and I mutate the worst half. So it's basically changing parameters, and then I iterate. It's really like classical evolutionary computation. I don't want to spend too much time on this because there is no, nothing really mysterious there. It's really like you select a population of networks and then you try to modify it based on some scoring function, which is going to account for the phenotype. Okay, so now this is to answer your question. So, fitness computation. So, I want to go from fly to mosquito, so I need to impose some mosquito constraint on the fly network. And so, the way I'm going to do this is that I will have a scoring function to score the performance of my network. There will be two components in this scoring function. The first component is going to be to force this inversion of giant and hunchback, and so I'm doing this in a very stupid way. I'm just telling, I give some kind of idealized hunchback and giant profile that I want in mosquito, and then I compute the difference between these profiles and the actual profile and the desired profile, and that gives me a score. And I want to minimize the score. So there are many ways to do this. I've tried different things to do it. That does not quite matter how you do this, as long as you impose that you want hunchback to become more anterior than giant. So that's the first component of the fitness. And then, okay, so the most important part is the fitness, is the part related to stripe. Because I have this problem of E5 conundrum, and I call the E5 conundrum, that if I remove giant, then I have this huge stripe, and then you have something that is not working. So what I want to do, I want to have something in my fitness function that accounts for the conservation of the stripe, but that accounts for it in a rather qualitative way. And what I mean by qualitative is that there are actually some flexibility in the stripe position. There are possibilities, flexibility in the stripe positioning and the stripe lengths and the stripe widths if you look at actual mutants. So this is a spectacular example of fly mutant where you can see this. So this is an hypomorph for E4 and 6. So you see E4 and 6 are barely expressed here. And so that's a wild-type animal. So this is the animal, one of the animals corresponding to this mutant. And so if you compare the wild-type to this fly, you see that it's missing segment. So it's interesting to see that, when I saw that, I was very puzzled because I always have in mind this very precise fly positioning of stripe and stuff like this. But then you realize that, actually, if you remove one if stripe, the fly is basically fine. I mean, it's shorter, but it's fine. So that means that, if in terms of evolution, it means that, you can allow yourself some plasticity probably in the stripe positioning, even the stripe number. So I'm not going to allow myself flexibility in the stripe numbers because I'm not that bold, basically. But what I do for my fitness function, I'm going to count the number of if stripe, and I want to make sure that there is at least 7 if stripe, or 6 because I forget about if one. But I'm essentially counting the number of if stripe, and I just want to make sure that there are enough if stripe. Yes?
I'm a little confused by the logic.
Yeah.
So it's not at all obvious to me that fly is flying.
Oh, it's flying. Okay.
So,
you need to read the paper.
Okay. It's flying.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it's fertile.
Yeah, but
okay, but that,
5%
that, okay.
Differential in fitness is a rather big deal.
Sure, but that,
Hold on just a second.
Yeah.
So, if you relax this notion of fitness, you can surely go from one place to the other.
Yeah.
But evolution doesn't particularly take you from one place.
Yeah.
Evolution doesn't necessarily have fixed initial condition and final condition. Mm-hmm. Right. So the issue is, if you rigidly fix your constraint on stripes, basically you're very strict about fitness, you can ask, how many ways are there to wire that system?
Yeah. Okay.
Which is what.
But
you already asked.
So
what you're doing is you're rewiring it inside.
Yeah.
You're saying, imposing this whatever hourglass constraint, how much parametric phase space is there to set up the upstream thing?
Yeah, yeah. No, I certainly agree with you. I'm relaxing a lot the notion of fitness. I'm not relaxing this as much as can be seen here. I'm just telling that I need stripes, and I need them correctly positioned with respect to each other. This is what I'm going to say. But that, you're right.
But
you're
I'm
right.
I'm a little surprised you need to relax at all. I'm a little surprised you need to relax at all.
Okay, so if I take, maybe it's a statement on the model. If I take this model and if I don't relax it, that's not going to work.
So to me, that says that you need to add something to this model so that you have more degeneracy to not have to go uphill.
Well, okay, you see the result, and I question, when you see the result, given the result and given the prediction it makes on how you compare it to the actual insects, I don't think that. Well, I don't know. But you're right. It's a good point. I certainly need to relax the fitness notion here, in the sense of relaxing the constraint of stripe positioning. That's true. And so either I fix the fitness very strongly and then I give some freedom in the network, or even I do a relatively simple network and then I relax the fitness. I have to make.
If you relax things enough, you'll always be able to go up and down.
Yeah, but you don't want to relax too much so that you get nonsense.
Okay.
So and you don't get nonsense here.
And
what? Hopefully.
Well, I don't understand what you're saying. So you're telling me that I can have fewer stripes and it's fine.
Yeah.
Presumably, evolution should be able to go through those intermediates. But then
yeah, that's kind of the idea here. It's a bit more relaxed than saying you have this stripe needs to be here for the fly to be alive and to reproduce.
Then why you? I mean, the top part of your slide says I can have four stripes or whatever.
Yeah.
And the bottom part says you're going to insist on having at least.
Yeah, no, but that's because, what I mean here is that there is some plasticity. I mean, you're right, maybe this fly is not that well, but I just want to say, I don't have.
Your part is you want to be more relaxed than defending
yeah,
that you have.
Yeah,
stress.
Yeah. Essentially what I'm telling you is that if I have a slightly larger stripe, it's plausible that your fly is fine, basically. Because if it's missing stripes, it's not that far from being fine. It's kind of, do you see what I mean? No, okay.
No, I see what you mean, but I mean, I could just take your argument even further and say.
And say, I don't care about stripes.
Yeah, or why do you need, if you just show me the fly.
Okay, I'm actually happy if you only want six stripes. No, but what I mean is I want stripes. You see, I add some constraints later. Okay, I want some stripes. That's what I want. And I'm not. My fitness notion is coarse grain in this way. I want stripes. Okay, so
to make sure I get things right, the set of regulatory interactions.
Yeah, I fix it.
Fixed.
I fix it.
Is that reasonable? I mean, over long.
Okay, we want it. Okay, so again, that's kind of. Along the same discussion, if I allow to add many, many interactions, that seems a bit less complicated I don't really have a good control about what happens. If I fix the parameters and do this, I can, it's basically a well-constrained problem. And you'll see what happens. And I think it's still predictive. I mean, these kind of assumptions only matter. Okay. Let me. So now, let me show. So now I have. So that was essentially the introduction, and now I will give you what is happening when you do this. And so I start with my fly model. Okay. So Eve, blah blah blah. And so now I want to constrain it so that Hunchback, to get the mosquito part, I want Hunchback to become more anterior, and then Giant essentially to disappear. So Hunchback is in pink, and Giant is this blue thing here. And so I just show you successful simulations. The simulations are not always working, but I show you the result of one simulation. And so that's one step in the evolution. So you saw. So if you compare the two slides, you see that. So maybe focus here. You see that this Hunchback here gets more anterior. Oops. Oh, sorry. So Hunchback gets more anterior. As it goes more anterior, if you compare these two slides here, it's basically split this stripe in two. So you have one new stripe appearing in the posterior. Okay? And so once you have one new stripe appearing in the posterior, actually, it's good because that satisfies my constraint that I need to have at least seven stripes. So actually, so this animal will potentially have eight stripes. So that's interesting to notice. But then once I have this, actually, it's been that if I want to have if I have a minimum number of threads required, then it means that I can get rid of E5. So I can get rid of E5. And so once I get rid of E5, I can easily get rid of giant. And so that gives me my mosquito. Essentially my mosquito. And so the difference between fly and mosquito then, you know, the primitive difference between fly and mosquito is based on, so everything is happening between these two guys. Essentially, this guy is giving one of those stripes in the posterior so that you don't need this E5 stripes. So that will be my mosquito. So I show it to you again, maybe. So this is fly. So you have this stripe here and then an E5 stripe here. What happens is that hunchback is becoming more anterior. It's splitting this stripe in two so that you don't need E5 anymore. And you can get rid of E5. And so you don't need to have, you no longer have this problem of giant no longer being expressed because you don't really have an E5 corresponding E5 in mosquito. So basically, here's a prediction from this very, very simple simulations. You need to create an extra stripe in the posterior because hunchback is getting more anterior, and then this allows you to suppress E5. So that sounds like yes?
So that was one simulation?
Okay, it's very reproducible. I will show you another one.
I guess you show how many solutions you found.
Yeah. There are many solutions, and most of them are working like this. I show you another simulation in 1 second. But this qualitative scenario, having hunchback moving more anterior, that creates a new room for a new stripe in the posterior so that you can get rid of E5, this is something that is very, very reproducible qualitatively. I mean, quantitatively as well.
I mean, you require hunchback to move.
Yeah, but that's because I see it more anterior in the mosquito. So that's one of my constraints in my machine landscape. Okay, but the advantage of this, yes?
Don't you miss a stripe here?
No, because you create a new one so that you can remove another one.
And you're supposed to have 8 stripes in the
middle. Okay, I come back to this 8 stripe thing. I tell you. You're right, you're missing another stripe, but you see, we can put it back. I show you. Okay, the important thing is that this gives you an immediate prediction. It tells you that what happens is that essentially E5, the E5 in fly does not exist in mosquito. And so that means that the stripe in fly and mosquito are not homologous. And what that means that the E4 stripes in mosquito are actually homologous to E4-6 fly in fly. And that gives you an immediate experimental test, very visual. So this will be the fly pattern. You have hunchback, knurps, hunchback. And so roughly, you have knurps and E5, which are overlapping here. So now what happens if I get rid of E5 in fly, then you get a situation where there is no leaf here. And so now when you're counting the stripes, you have E4 here, E4 here, and then E5 here, and then E4 here, and then E5 is not in the middle of knurps, but it's on the right of knurps, and E4 and E5 are positioned symmetrically with respect to knurps. While here, you have E4 and 6 which are positioned symmetrically, and E5 in the middle. So that gives you an immediate experimental prediction. You can try to look at individual flies and see if you see that. And that works beautifully. So this is Clognia, and this is fly. So just to illustrate you, this is what I've just told you in fly. So this is E4, 5, 6. Knurps is roughly, so E4 and 6 are roughly symmetrical with respect to knurps. And then E5 in the middle, so you are in this situation. Now if you look at Clognia, if you look at E4 and 5, E4 and 5, they are symmetric with respect to knurps. So this is completely consistent with the evolution scenario we have simulated. And that's basically a prediction. You know, that's a prediction of the simulation, and you get this. Yes?
But could you have guessed it without the model, just from knowing that decoy was not there, that E5 was controlled by decoy?
I can always probably guess in retrospect,
but
somehow this is a rationalization of this guess. I mean, nobody. The thing I can tell you is that as far as we can see, nobody has proposed this. So, you know, it's coming from a prediction of our model. It's really a prediction, and you can check the prediction. So I think it means that our model is not completely wrong. So anyway, okay. So let me go on. So this is very reproducible. So this is to answer Alexander's question, qualitatively, in the sense that sometimes this is this trap that is split in another one. Sometimes it's going to be this trap. So for instance, this simulation is a case where you create a stripe using this module and not that module, another stripe in the posterior. And so then this is the same story. Once you create another stripe in the posterior, then you can just get rid of E5, and so you get your fly. You get your mosquito. So then, that what is interesting is that, so we see in the simulation that essentially our prediction will be that in mosquito, you're somehow reusing the E6 or 7 stripe of fly to make another stripe in the posterior. But then what happens if both were reused in the posterior to make two stripes? You could potentially do that. And so then your prediction will be that mosquito 5, 6, and 7, 8 would be mirror image of each other with and back in the middle. This is what you see in the simulation. So just to recapitulate, in fly, you have E6, E7, and hunchback. In mosquito, you have E5, E6, hunchback, E7, and E8. And basically, this is a prediction of our mechanism for creating new stripes. So now you can go back, look at the in-situs in mosquito, and basically you cannot really see it, but that's exactly what happens. So this is an hunchback plus Eve in-situ, and well, it's more visible on the actual paper, unfortunately, but you see that hunchback is exactly here, and so you have E5, E6, E7, E8, and E5, E6 are symmetrical with respect to E7 and E8. So basically, this is what we know, what would be a very natural prediction of our evolutionary scenario. And again, you look at mosquito and you see that it works.
But again, you have many scenarios. Or do you produce a sort of family of models, or
you produce families of models. You know, each simulation is going to give you slightly different results. But qualitatively, they're all working the same way by this reusing of fly modules to create new stripes in the posterior.
The way they do this creation could differ.
Yeah, it could differ. Absolutely, absolutely.
It doesn't mean that 100% of your simulation do that. Or
no. Yeah, some simulations do not work.
Give us a number of how many.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So these things, these ones are really, you know, they work very efficiently. Like maybe 30 or 40% of the simulations succeed in creating, in basically creating new stripes and removing E5. But you know, I think the prediction is not on specific simulation. I think what is really what makes this result quite strong and interesting is that you redo the simulation and you see qualitatively the same scenario. That helps you understand. I think this is a strong suggestion of what happens in evolution. Yes.
Well, this idea of reusing, it's funny, right? You could have had one enhancer that just read off basically one Eve stripe per enhancer.
Yeah.
But by having these multiple things, you're sort of making yourself more susceptible to upstream mutate or something, right? I guess I'm asking for your...
Yeah, so you're asking why am I not creating new enhancers?
For example.
But I mean, it's just that at least evolutionary speaking, I guess my guess would be that it's easier, you know, it's a bricolage. It's a famous evolutionary bricolage. It's easier to use what is existing here already to rather than reinvent something, reinventing the wheel.
Isn't that also the question? I mean, would your simulation actually allow to make
so okay, so here, so the thing, okay, here I try not to do that because I wanted to see with pure bricolage can I do it,
right?
And I can do it with pure bricolage,
right?
That's my statement, and my pure bricolage is giving me predictions.
Very good.
So I like it.
Yeah. Very good.
But you're right. I mean, you can the space of possible is potentially infinite, but I need to constrain it some way. So I relax the fitness, but everything else I somehow kept it controlled. I hope. Okay. Okay. So now it's really becoming a bit geeky because now we have told you about Eve, but what about the other Peru genes? And so here we are a bit more speculative. I thought we had very nice predictions for Eve, but I think that kind of makes sense. For Peru genes, we're not quite sure what is happening, but there are interesting facts that I want to point you out. There is this very nice review by Schroeder describing what happens to the other Perul genes. And in fly, so what is very striking in fly is that most of the Perul genes are really nicely positioned by the gap genes in a very similar way to Eve. So for instance, this one here, so for instance, you get runt. So this means that runt is basically regulated the same way as E4 here. I mean, you see that you have all these different modules, and so even, you know, essentially the other pair of genes in fly are positioned in a very similar way compared to very similar way to Eve. Okay, so now you can just ask the question, so now can I do a model where I have Eve and the other pair of genes? And so we tried, so there is one distinction in pair of genes. I'm sorry, again, it's relatively geeky. The pair of genes which are directly directly regulated by gap genes are called primary. And if per-rule expressions are regulated by other per-rule genes, they are more secondary. So there is a distinction between primary and secondary. So if we assume that all per-rule genes are primary in our simulations, I cannot find any solution even when you're relaxing the fitness. That simply does not work. Because the important thing is that what I require is that I should keep the alternation between, I should keep the polarity of perugin. I should have Harry's and Eve's and runs and futs to have proper segmentation. And so now, if these positionings are defined purely by gap genes, it's going to be very difficult to get rid of one E stripe, because if I want to get rid of one E stripe, I need to get rid essentially of all other perugins. And so the evolution scenario I've told you about does not make sense. It's not possible. So that's why it's not possible to do that. But what we realized then is that, so I told you there is this E5 conundrum, and just next to E5 there is FUTS4, so it's here. And so if you look at this picture, interestingly, FUTS4, they don't know what it's doing, they don't know how it's regulated, but you have what is called the 7-stripe enhancer, and 7-stripe enhancer are essentially secondary per-rule genes, so it's an enhancer that are regulated by other per-rule genes. And so what this means that the FUTS4 is not directly regulated by gap genes, it's probably regulated by other primary genes. And so then what we've done is that we assume now that FUTS4, only FUTS4 is regulated by Eve, and we redo simulation assuming FUTS4 is only regulated by Eve. And so now if we do the simulation, essentially now that works. So this is the simulation, so this is Eve, this is FUTS. And so we assume that FUTS is regulated sandwiched between Eve. Other FUTS genes, other FUTS stripes are regulated by gap genes as usual. And so now we redo the evolutionary simulation, assuming that FUTS4 only is regulated by Eve. And so then what happens? So I show you again the successful simulation. They are much more challenging to converge, actually, because something needs to happen to have a solution. And what needs to happen is that essentially FUTS4 is completely overwriting in some ways the other FUTS regulatory gene. You need to have many, many FUTS4 essentially stripes. It needs to become the main driver of FUTS expression. And so once you have this, basically FUTS is repressed by Eve, and so now it's completely that the system is completely slaved to Eve. And if the system is completely slaved to Eve, you can do the same scenario that you duplicate one Eve stripe and then get rid of E5, and eventually you get something like that. So it's that's basically what happens. So essentially what I'm telling you is that if I assume that other per-rule genes are slave to Eve, this is the only way for me to get to conserve, to get the same result as before. I need the per-rule genes to be slave to Eve in some way. So in Drosophila they are not, but evolutionarily speaking, for my simulations to work, I need that FUTS and other ones are actually slave to Eve. So that would be a prediction for the ancestors that there are mostly secondary perugins and not that many primary perugins in the posterior, at least. In the anterior, it's okay, you can keep them. So that's a prediction of my simulation. So I told you about Eve and FUTS. Now we have another scenario, which is we need another. So it's more like a speculation than an actual prediction. What the problem we have is that, so if you have Eve, FUTS. It's relatively easy to say FUTS is repressed by Eve, and so that gives you the polarity. But not what you have is not Eve, FUTS, you have Harry, Eve, run FUTS, Harry, Eve, runs FUTS. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, I think you can see keeping this alternation is much more difficult than keeping the on-off, on-off alternation. And so now the question we had is, how is it possible to get this one, this alternation in this evolutionary simulation? And so we don't have a good answer to this. We just have a proposal, which is to use the one very well-known fact, that maybe this proposal again, there is the fact that you have, Eve is not static. Eve is actually moving with respect to time. And what happens is that Eve stripes are moving anteriorly. So these are the data from Klognia and Drosophila as a function of time showing you where the stripes are moving. And you see that as time goes, the stripes are moving more anteriorly. So you, it's not like you have each stripe and they don't move. It's like you make each stripe and then they move a little bit towards the anterior. And the assumption, so the, our idea is that this motion, this anterior motion, so it's a bit like, you know, somewhere, or maybe it's a bit like a clock, I don't know. But somewhere this motion is giving you polarity information that will help position pair regions.
So they move with what?
They move with respect to time. So they start
from the common ancestor.
No. During development, they move a little bit. So you know, at T3, I don't know, T5, T6 is here, and T8 it's here. So you have a kind of small wave, local wave of Eve, and everything is moving a little bit. And so now you can see the idea is very stupid, is that if you have some motion like this, you can use that to define polarity within your segment because that gives you a polarity information. No, you don't agree with that?
How do you know that the nuclei just moved?
No! You see the stripes. I think you see the stripes. Okay.
How do you know that it's not the nuclei that are?
No, I'm pretty sure it's not. I haven't looked nuclei by nuclei, but if you look, there are the data. We can look together. I'm pretty sure it's not the case.
Well, they also get narrower.
Yeah, they get narrower and they move.
That's the bigger.
Both. But essentially, there is some temporal information, spatial temporal information. That would be my idea. Okay. I'm speculating. But essentially, I'm telling you, if you use the usual cross repression that are known actually from the pair genes to have. And then you assume that there is some kind of motion of Eve, it's actually relatively easy to build a network that is able to read the polarity when you move Eve. And so it's just a simulation illustrating this, so it's a bit a dummy simulation where I just moved Eve in the anterior with a network where of cross repression of feral genes. And so then when you do that, well, actually you will see eventually you get as a proper 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 alternation. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So my point is just to tell, if you can use this motion to find polarity, then you can use it as positional information to potentially position properly the pair regions. So again, that's very speculative here, but it was a way to answer the question, you know, how can you do all the four genes? Well, if you assume that there is something a bit like that, it's possible in theory. Okay, so I'm going to conclude and then somehow summarize everything I've told you. And so for me, it's really an order of what I call plausibility of evidence. So I think the strongest result is this business of E4-5that doesn't look homologous between different dipterans. And so I think we can make a prediction and check on Klognia that it was true. So I think it's relatively convincing to me, at least. We predict some symmetries of the enhancer, which are purely based on the evolution and the phase. Oh yeah, one thing I should point out on this: we get the good relative positioning of the Eve stripes, even with respect to gap genes. Even so, we have not really constrained at all, actually, the width of the Eve stripe. So this is an example of you get something, you get more than you put, I think, in the beginning, because you get prediction of the relative positioning without really imposing the width of the stripe. So we somehow have this symmetries of enhancer that we saw in mosquito. So we say that basically E45, E67, E58 in mosquitoes are the same enhancers. I mean, not all of them are the same, but the E4 and 5 are regulated by the same enhancer as mosquito and so on. So for our scenario to work, we really need that pair of genes are secondary. they cannot be primary. So this is also a strong constraint. This, you know, if you demonstrate that in the ancestral fly, all peril genes are primary, we are wrong. You know, it's very strong. It's very strong necessity in our model to have them secondary. And so, you know, the only way we can think about having something keeping the polarity and evolving the way we predict is if we have some kind of wave-like Eve motion in the ancestor. You know, maybe we're not creative enough, or maybe all this approach is wrong. But you know, maybe this indicates. You know, I mean, we know that there are the other insects have some wave and Eve much closer to the segmentation clock invertebrates. I mean, at least qualitatively. So it's not that does not sound like a completely stupid idea. So that's the conclusion for the fly. Now I can make another conclusion relative to the dual approach, and I'm sure everything can be really discussed here. I think when you do this evolution computation, you usually find more than you put. So for instance, we could somehow predict the position of these stripes relative to gap genes, even though that was not really constrained by our fitness function. So I like this idea that, you know, somehow touch some kind of constraint in the system, and you can uncover it using this simulation. Computational evolution in this context actually it works quite well and it's reproducible with these constraints. So maybe you can really say the constraints are not so well, but with these constraints it works well. And I think the general lesson from this is that this kind of machine learning approach, when you have limited data, actually that works quite well to try to generate new prediction hypotheses like this E45. Homology, which are different in Colombia and in mosquito. Okay, so that's pretty much it. So I have a slide recapitulating our prediction from this approach with the different enhancers in different species color-coded. I just wanted to mention that you can do much more sophisticated things as well. I mean, I don't know if you can do much more sophisticated things, but you can. So I've been interested in segmentation invertebrate, and you can really recover a clock on reference system based on only the constraint that you make some stripes. So that's the problem we've been doing a long time ago. And so it's just to tell you that these approaches are, you know, we applied it to mosquito and fly, but potentially you can apply it to anything and get hopefully useful prediction. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. Oh, yes, Christian?
I've gone a little bit lost in that you evolved from the Drosophila pattern to the Anopheles.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But what you wanted to do at the start, I thought, was to find the ancestral
pattern. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So can you now explain what was the ancestral
pattern? Yeah, you're right. You're right.
How did they evolve to these two different
patterns? I haven't told much. That's true. I somehow skipped what really is the ancestral. So the ancestral pattern is a bit like this. So it's basically, it looks a bit like Clogmia to us. So you would have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, very much like, actually, this figure is not quite correct. 5 should be more here. Okay. The ancestor will look more like this. And this figure is not very clear. We expect the ancestor, the kind of saddle, to look a little bit like this, where 4 and 5 are positioned symmetrically to knurps. And then you have a 6th stripe, which is like the third stripe. And then, is there a 7th stripe? We are not quite sure. In Colombia, the 7th stripe appears post-castration. So plausibly, it could be the same in the ancestor. Also, what is consistent with this is that this posterior hunchback appears much later in mosquito than in fly and in Colombia. So I would say the ancestor looks a little bit like Colombia. That would be my prediction. But of course, I don't quite know. You know, I don't know. I cannot tell. This is the ancestor. The only thing I can tell, the very strong prediction I can tell on the ancestor is that it should not have E5 stripe like Clomia. It should not have this E5 stripe, and it should have an E5, which is essentially a duplication of E4. That's really the only very strong prediction. The other things I cannot exactly know if it's an ancestor or if it's coming. Like, for instance, the hunchback dining, I don't quite know. So there are several possibilities here. Okay. Yes?
So trying to see the forest
Okay.
Recognize the trees. So yeah. You sort of presented very nicely sort of few stories about this stripe evolving and that stripe evolving. Yeah. In a way, the data, right, what you've also emphasized is that, okay, even looking at Eve, there are constraints of having stripes.
Yeah.
When you add other parallel genes, there are even more constraints.
Yeah.
Your problem ultimately is that that stuff is shared in your clay. But the flexibility is in the patterns of giant NURBS, blah blah blah. So, in a way, the distance between these species, as far as this is concerned, is in the sort of distance difference between the patterns of gap genes. Right? So we can just use pixels to define distance, but we can say that is not a useful measure of evolutionary distance.
Yeah.
Useful measure of evolutionary distance is how many substitutions of little
inhibitions
and activations in your network have to evolve in order to generate conserved response now to this different. So I can imagine if you then come up with some measure of evolutionary complexity or evolutionary distance in the number of changed terms in your bunch of differential equations. Assuming that that's what evolution does, parameters of these things, then you can actually define
evolutionary distance
as Felsenstein would do, just counting mutations, and then we count mutations
in
the genomes, and boom, boom, boom,
absolutely.
The constructed
So
I think what you're trying to do is define the measure of distance in networks. But this question of understanding, if you like, the structure of this, we cannot define measure of distance without understanding something about the structure of the space.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And in this case, your space is the space of patterns of gap genes. And somehow we come back to this question, maybe if you assume something about the networks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you make a little bit different assumptions.
Yeah.
Will that space,
So it's good that we're coming back to this. So, what do we need for this to work? I think that maybe I'm not answering quite the question, but what do we need for this scenario to work? We actually need very few things. For this scenario to work, we just need to have this kind of symmetries between these enhancers. I mean, you just need to recycle two enhancers of Drosophila to do the new stripe in Chromia and Anopheles. And the way you recycle these enhancers, I don't think that matters too much as you keep the inputs. And then we need to somehow move the gap genes, giant and hunchback, with respect to each other. So we just need this kind of minimum ingredients. And if you, I'm sure if you decorate this network,
that's what I'm sort of struggling with.
Yeah.
You have a rather minimal tree there, right?
Yeah.
There are only three leaves.
Yeah.
But suppose your NIH gives you
$1 million,
and you can do in situs on 30 other species.
Okay. So
the question is, where would you even look in the tree? Where would most information
so
come from?
People have tried this actually. Okay. So people have many flies here. They all look like Drosophila. It's horrible. I mean, for me, you know, you change a bit the parameters, and then you get, and so there are papers on this, like, oh yeah, if you just reinforce a little bit this feedback, then you get slightly different temporal thing, and which is interesting. I'm not saying it's not interesting, but essentially, most of the data are here. What I would love to have more data here, of course, because this
well,
is
maybe
where
you should be looking even further than the mosquito, I don't know.
Yeah, but well, you
but
could...
what would you predict? So I can imagine maybe okay. you're saying that there are only two strikes that can be shuffled in this game.
Yeah, I would say something like this, that there are only... So everything, the game is happening here. So and this corresponds to two enhancers. So I would say only these enhancers can really be shuffled and reused during this posterior
game. So then the strong prediction that no matter how many species will be in situ in between Annapolis and Drosophila, nobody will ever see anything shuffled except for five.
Yeah, I would say that. I would say that. That's a prediction. And and also maybe there is something, I went very quickly on that, but there is a dynamical aspect here that is like the posterior thing, there is a temporal aspect in the posterior. And I think this is what allows you to actually evolve and reshuffle this stripe enhancers. So, yeah. And just a comment on the parameters. It's actually surprisingly easy to just change, you need probably to change maybe four or five parameters of Drosophila to get this, because it's very easy to exchange giant and hunchback and then to get rid of E5 and everything follows. So distance is relatively small, but it's not that clear how, you need to make some assumption on the fitness to get to really get the pathway. So that's why also the fitness landscape, it looks like a saddle because, as you say, we need to relax some constraints. So what does that mean?
Well, can you go outside Iptera? Can you look? I'm not probably getting my
phylogeny. So I tried to, I looked a bit at, Minoptera seems complicated because actually they are further than Coleoptera, I think. This is a new phylogeny. It's
so, I mean bees and wasps.
Yeah, bees and wasps, but the problem of bees, bees and wasps, so I have a slide on bees and wasps. So this is this slide. So that is an interesting fact. I told you the conundrum went from E5. So the segmentation of wasp is completely different from, it's essentially the same anterior to E5, but completely different posterior to E5. So there is something happening right here. And posterior to E5, it's more like, it looks a bit more like arthropod segmentation, where you have this this wave, and then you split the stripes. It looks a bit more like this. So there's a completely different posterior patterning in wasps. But I cannot see, here it's still kind of the same. But now the question is that how do you... But then to me it makes a lot of sense. No, I told you actually about this splitting of stripes, I mean, maybe I'm a bit too much speculative here. But it makes a lot of sense if you have a clock to reuse a lot the same enhancers to make many stripes. And here you also can have this notion of splitting a stripe, a big stripe in two, and which is a bit like what you see in this arthropod. So there could be a connection that can be built, but I haven't thought about that.
Okay. So I guess if I sort of summarize what you told us, it's that if you want to switch the giant to hunchback expression, you don't want to lose too many stripes. There's only one way to do it.
Yeah, kind of, yes. As far as I can see,
That's the way that you do it.
Without creating new enhancers and stuff like this.
Within your framework.
Within my framework, like just by pure bricolage.
But could one be even more relaxed and say, maybe I just want to get more stripes?
Yeah.
And then maybe there's multiple ways to do that, but maybe one of them is the mosquito, and maybe some of them are other insects. Or would it be interesting to do that kind of exercise where you have a less constrained evolution.
But when I do this exercise, I'm not telling really. I'm telling this mosquito in the sense that I have hunchback becoming more anterior. Yeah, you're right. But I'm not telling anything about the way I want to do stripes. It just comes from the evolution.
Compared to your earlier work, right, you're putting. Not that you're not getting on more than you put in. You obviously are, but you're putting in
We put more information.
You just said, I want to make as many stripes as I can. Yeah. And here's some networks to make stripes, right? So you're just
I've already answered this question. I know how to make as much stripe as I can. I need a clock. I know that.
I understand that. But now I'm saying, starting from here, could it be less constrained and get a variety of different things that move in a mosquito-like direction and ask whether evolution...
But then I would need to relax some of the hypothesis. Maybe I want to be able to add some regulation and stuff like this. But if the thing is also, if you open up completely the field, I'm just going to get this back. I need to constrain it a little bit
in some way. If you start with some additional plausible model for Drosophila?
Okay, my experience with this evolution simulation, especially if you use this coarse grain fitness, is that it's easier to just, you know, it's easier to make a clock than just to reuse this.
So it'll throw out everything.
Yeah. Except if you constrain it in some nice way. I mean, maybe you can do that, but maybe you need to do this to somehow get to the Hymenopteras. So that's possible. Yeah, actually, yeah, so that's something I haven't told you, which is very important. I constrain the anterior thing, because if you don't constrain the anterior thing, it's not working. So I need to keep the stripes and the gap genes. I'm sorry, I forgot to say that, to somehow reuse what I've been doing in the anterior. So if I do this and then I impose, I want as many stripes as possible, maybe I see something like a clock. That could be, I don't know.
Well, if you have a finite number of gap stripes, then there are limit to how many eavesdrops
you're right, but so then that would be a scenario that you would have several gap stripes appearing and making you many stripes. You're using the even answers. Yeah.
But isn't there a limit to how many you can make with simple regulation and limited number of
Yes, in this framework, yes, because it's the gap genes are okay.
And essentially, you're just putting one between two.
You could imagine that you have an oscillator of the gap genes, for instance, due to cross repression. So then, God knows what how many stripes that could make many stripes. But that's very all of this is very speculative. I mean, this is already speculative, but this is even more speculative. So. Okay.